apparently they've created this massive mouse hospital in Houston. You could just set this little drama in a mouse hospital.
General Mouse Hospital. Coming up, the scientific breakthroughs of mice and medicine, plus a plan to save the post office.
How many people would have to send charming handwritten letters to keep the US post office going?
Celebrities behaving badly.
Well, what are you going to do? You can't throw him out mid-air because the guy's taking a pee. They were coming into land.
And who knew the State Department had a sense of humour?
Your power in the State Department is inversely proportionate to the number of words in your title. And so I'm the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labour. So that tells you how much attention you need to pay to me.
You're listening to Chatter from America with Henry Timms from the 92nd Y.
In homage to Alistair Cook, we launched Chatter from America, which is a story of three British people in New York scurrying around the subways and trying to shed some light onto the world.
Matthew Bishop from The Economist.
Hello, we're going to start.
And me, Femi Okay, from WNYC Radio.
Hold on a minute, what is that noise I hear? Oh, yeah, Alistair Cook turning in his grave.
When was the last time you bought a stamp?
Last week. I bought some last week.
I bought one this week for the first time in about a month. Matthew?
I've forgotten what they are. I think they used to have the Queen on them, didn't they, in England? And maybe
these are things that some of your assistants use at The Economist.
Really?
Yeah, to make mail go places.
The reason I ask is because...
I just put the letter in a little box and it goes away.
It just mails itself. The reason I ask is because the US mail service right now is in a major crisis. $5 billion in debt. So they're thinking, how do we save money? One of the ways is turning first-class mail, which I didn't realise actually, but gets there the next day anywhere you send it, pretty much in the United States. This is really impressive. But as from next spring, they are going to be slowing down the mail. So it will seriously be snail mail. So instead of taking a day, it will take 2 to 3 days. And Matthew, this is where it might actually affect your business, is that periodicals will take 2 to 9 days.
Yeah, no, we're actually quite worried about this at The Economist because our whole business model really is aimed at ensuring that the magazine gets to all our readers on a Saturday morning at the latest. A lot of our readers get their copy via the US mail. And so if there is no Saturday morning delivery, which seems to be quite likely as part of this change, then I'm going to have to work earlier in the week, maybe, or stay up all night or something to get the story done so that we can stick it off in the post that bit earlier and get it to our readers on Friday. You know, my underlying suspicion, though, is that the US mail... it's just very, very badly run. I mean, one of the things that I was told by... I met the inventor of the Segway. You know that silly thing that with the two wheels that you stand
like
on?
Like a little scooter.
Yeah. The Segway, if you remember, was launched as like the greatest invention since sliced bread. And then it sort of flopped. And it's now sort of you see some cities where you can ride around a Segway with a tour guide. But apparently what was going to happen was the US mail was going to buy the first round of major orders for these things. And so so all the postmen would be... riding along on their segways. And that meant they could probably deliver 10 times as many letters each as they do by foot. But then the unions at the last minute said, hang on a minute, that means we're all going to, like 90% of us are going to be out of a job. And so they blocked this order. And so I think what really should be done is that they should, instead of cancelling Saturday delivery or going to snail mail, they should go to Segway mail instead.
Are you being unkind to the post office on the basis that there's a difference between being a badly run business and just having a bad business model? Sending bits of mail in the post which take a day or two to get anywhere, unless there are things as valuable as The Economist, is just not something which is going to grow in the coming years.
You make a prediction that 2012 will be the year of the handwritten letter. I think that there's this reaction against modernity and social media and all that kind of stuff. And that the thing that's going to really stand out is if you take the trouble to write a letter, stick it in the mail and send it off to someone, that's going to carry a sort of...
I agree.
An extra weight that no one else... That these sort of email, you just can't replicate that sort
I'm
of
sure
effort.
I'm sure that's true, but I can't imagine that your romantic people writing their letters by hand is going to sustain the US Post Office.
Well, it would if they did their job properly.
Actually, so how many people would have to send charming handwritten letters to keep the US Post Office going?
Well, it depends. We sent one or two each a week. I think that would be fine.
Henry, Matthew, I almost fell off my chair this week as I was doing the news. And there's certain bits of news that you expect from the State Department. You expect to hear about Iran sanctions, Syria sanctions. I did not expect to hear Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking about promoting gay rights around the world.
The Obama administration defends the human rights of LGBT people as part of our comprehensive human rights policy and as a priority of our foreign policy.
I was absolutely stunned because it's bold, it's brave, and I've been around many countries where you will not only get arrested, you will get killed if people find out that you're not straight. I really wanted to go to the State Department and ask them how they came up with this idea, why they came up with this idea, and the whole timing. Dan Baer is the Deputy Assistant Secretary at the US State Department from the Democracy and Human Rights and Labour section. Dan, did I get your title right?
Yes, more or less.
Do you want to correct me?
Don't correct her. That's a terrible risk.
It's very good. Yes, Democracy, Human Rights, and Labour. You know, they say they told me when I started, your power in the State Department is inversely proportionate to the number of words in your title, and so I'm the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labour. So that tells you how much attention you need to pay to me.
You're extremely powerful. Why now? This is a remarkable policy to start promoting around the world.
It was a year and a half ago or more now that the Secretary sent out a cable to all ambassadors, all of our ambassadors in the world, all chiefs of mission, instructing them that part of our comprehensive human rights policy included paying attention to and engaging on the human rights of LGBT people. And that means not only raising concerns with governments when they arise, but also making sure that, you know, all ambassadors are supposed to get out there in the community, get to know people, et cetera. And so making sure that local LGBT groups are invited to the 4th of July party and things like that. So this is really, I see this not as a new thing, although certainly the speech was extraordinarily significant, but in terms of activity, it's a continuation of sustained engagement and sustained leadership from the Secretary.
How do you even tackle promoting gay rights in countries that think it's an unthinkable thing for people who aren't straight to be together?
The most awkward conversation is the first conversation. And in my experience, the first conversation hasn't been as awkward as I thought it might be. I've raised concerns about the human rights for LGBT people in a number of countries with a number of governments and ministers. And my honest takeaway is that actually these conversations tend to go better than one might think.
This may sound a slightly flip question, but I know the State Department has a lot of traditional cultural programs to promote American values. So, you know, the jazz musicians used to be taken around the world on cultural diplomacy initiatives. I mean, are you going to be pushing out sort of episodes of Will and Grace and Glee and sending the YMCA Village People tour on the world?
One of the brainstorms as I've thought about how to start conversations that I've had has been, I wonder what it would be like to take the cast of Glee on a trip, mainly because I think it would be interesting for them to explain why they think that the show has been so popular in the United States. So I don't know what the future holds. It's certainly what we'll see going forward is that we continue to ground the advocacy that we do and the engagement we do with foreign governments and with civil society abroad in a broader human rights policy, and that's how it belongs.
Mayor Bloomberg, in all of his offices here, has a big countdown clock which tells every member of his staff exactly how many days and hours and minutes they've got left until he leaves office. With the boldness and momentum coming out of the State Department right now, is this something that you're thinking about right now as Secretary Clinton, you know, has the end of her term in sight?
I actually don't think that this is something that will stop with the end of one person's tenure or the next administration, whenever that comes.
Unless it's President Backman, presumably.
I mean, or Perry.
I think those who are saying that, who suggest that, are really misjudging. I think there's been tremendous progress within the United States in recent years, and I don't see us losing that.
Dan, where are you chatting from, by the way? The people behind you are very chattery.
I'm sorry. I'm actually in The Hague. The Secretary gave a speech this evening in The Hague on internet freedom, and I was working on that as well.
So is that the science sound of war criminals being led off to trial in the background?
There's one question we ask all of our guests. What piece of music sums up their most significant piece of work this week?
Wow. For me, I think the most poignant part of the speech was where she talked about what the experience of love is in the context of the human experience, and how the issues that she was discussing in that speech were connected to something that was fundamental to the human experience, which is, for most of us, finding somebody to care about and to sacrifice for and care for is really a way that we find meaning and understanding of what it means to be human. So I guess I don't know what a perfect song would be, but it would be a love song, one about reckoning with that experience.
Just for the record, sign off with your official title for us.
My name is Dan Barron. I'm the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labour.
Thank you so much, Dan. Take care.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks so much.
He's very impressive. He also had lots of job titles.
What's next?
I want to talk about job titles just for a second, which is only because I was at dinner with someone from the UN. I won't say which mission he was from, or let's say he's from the British mission because he wasn't. In any case, he was at dinner and someone said, "So what is it you do?" And he said, "I'm the number three at the British Embassy." And his wife from across the table said, no, darling, tell them your real title." And he looked slightly embarrassed and said, "Well, okay, I guess I'm the second number two." And I always thought of myself, if you want the perfect example of where titles can take you going wrong, it's when you persuade yourself that you're not the number three, you're much more important than that, you're the second number two.
I love that.
So I had breakfast this week with someone who I think is written his first book, and actually is about to become quite important because he's saying some quite interesting and new things around health. It's a guy called Dr. David Agus, who is at USC. He was Steve Jobs' doctor. He was one of Steve Jobs' men.
Which doesn't necessarily recommend him, does it?
Well, that's the first thing I said to him, is that he's someone who is thought very highly of by a lot of very, very serious people. Steve Jobs is an interesting name in that respect. And his theory goes that if you live life more fully and more thoughtfully, you can actually prevent the vast majority of illnesses. Interesting things he said include, if you take an aspirin every single day, it significantly decreases your chances of having all number of different cancers. And he talks about a really interesting survey from the London buses. Those of you who remember the London buses, you have an upstairs and a downstairs, and there's a ticket collector who goes up and down, and a bus driver who drives
the
bus.
This was the 1960s, wasn't it?
1953. And so they measure the driver versus the guy walking up and downstairs. The guy walking up and downstairs has much lower rates of strokes, much lower rate of heart attacks. And he's now saying, and there's actually evidence out there to say, that if you actually make sure you're getting up and doing things on a regular basis, it is now scientifically proven that you can live a much fuller and longer life.
This is the old diet and exercise argument, then,
well,
isn't it?
Well, it's not quite common sense. It's not quite that, because actually he was saying if you get up in the morning feeling very virtuous and go do an hour of aerobics, and then you go sit in a desk for 12 hours, you're actually going to undo the work that you've done of your hour of aerobics. What it actually has to be about is actually getting up regularly, doing things regularly, actually moving the body around, not letting yourself just degenerate in your chair.
It's quite interesting because, you know, obviously one of the themes of this week in New York, the fashionable thing to do, is to have breakfast with a cancer doctor, because in fact that's what I did this week as well.
Are you feeling okay?
I'm feeling fine.
Okay, you got me worried.
No, I was having breakfast with the head.
This series is going quite well. I don't want to lose you.
I had breakfast with the new head of the MD Anderson Cancer Center, which is in Houston, Texas, and he has just announced his moonshot plan. He is going to pick 5 varieties of cancer and set out deliberately to cure them. Focus all the resources of his institute on curing them within 10 years, finding a cure. And apparently they've created this massive mouse hospital in Houston where they're giving all the mice different varieties of cancer, I guess, and treating them in different ways. They've figured out how to genetically engineer mice so that they're very similar to humans in their experiences. Obviously not in how they look and things yet, but... So I'm losing this completely.
You're trying to get through this serious comment without making a ridiculous joke.
I was inspired by it.
You
really
almost did it.
The guy,
I think
was,
the problem
it was
the
really
word
inspiring.
Mouse hospital was where that started hospital. Going wrong.
I just felt like this could be a fantastic way of educating the public about health issues, was that you could just set this little drama in a mouse hospital.
General Mouse Hospital.
Yeah, General Mouse Hospital. What was that film a few years ago with the mouse?
Stuart Little.
It could be Stuart Little Goes to Hospital. And they could just deal with all these different diseases and how people are trying to cure them and things, with mice dying in different hideous ways. Henry.
We are just in the short time after Alec Baldwin, who is our stablemate here at WNYC, so we are firmly in the Baldwin camp on this. He was ejected from an American Airlines plane, thus marking a pretty horrendously bad week for the PR team at American Airlines, who had to deal with the fact that they went bankrupt. The next week, they have Alec Baldwin on the plane, who, it seems, was thrown off for playing Scrabble.
It's just, it's, I think Words with Friends is the trademark name.
If so, I say Scrabble,
there will be major lawsuits.
It's also fair to say that I don't think anyone would get thrown off a plane if they were playing Scrabble.
Well, he was enjoying himself so much, he didn't turn his phone off and then went into the bathroom to continue playing.
Well, he probably had a very good word. I imagine that's what it was. He was probably about to play Quixotic, and he was just sitting there thinking, this is the one chance in life I'm going to get to play Quixotic. And then the stewardess comes and says, Alec, or Mr. Baldwin, I expect, Mr. Baldwin, you must sit down. And he thinks this is a chance worth taking.
I mean, he does make the very fair point that the news of him being evicted from the plane was broken by various of his fellow passengers tweeting, presumably via their mobile phones. He was maybe singled out for attention because he was a celebrity. I think the most interesting thing, I actually wrote a blog post about this. Fundamentally, there is nothing that an iPad can do to bring down a plane or to cause. It poses no safety hazard whatsoever. In fact, pilots of planes usually have their iPad on for the entire flight and use it for like
Words with Friends.
while the computer flies the plane. But I mean, maybe the iPad is even flying the plane. But I mean, there is absolutely no safety risk whatsoever. And so this is all being done as an exercise of petty power by the airlines. And the best theory I've heard is that they make us turn our devices off so that we watch the safety demonstration where they explain how to fit a seatbelt on. Yeah, actually, that doesn't explain it on the way down. You know, on the way up, that might make sense, but not on the way down. You know, I'm with Baldwin. Let's allow people to play with their devices on the planes, and let's have a bit more fun. And it just takes away all that gruesomeness of being stuck in tight seats and everything.
Well, I don't think he was in a tight seat.
No, well, he's quite a big man.
quite big seats. He wasn't the first actor or famous person to be thrown off a plane recently, because Gérard Depardieu. Gérard Depardieu was also thrown off a plane.
I think technically he wasn't, because when he urinated in the corridor,
the aisle.
He was airborne and they couldn't really throw him off.
They didn't throw him, they left him there.
Well, what are you going to do? You can't throw him out mid-air because the guy's taking a pee. They were coming in to land.
I just wonder whether
I think they made him leave the plane once they'd landed, but they did everybody.
I think there's one some sort of internal Hollywood parlor game going on where various film stars and entertainment people are trying to work out the most innocuous thing you can do and yet still get in trouble with an airline. So Alec Baldwin, having got through this, then commits Twittercide, which I think
he's deactivated.
He went from 600,000 followers to saying, enough, 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 I'm too big to tweet, no more for me, and now it's shut down.
That's
I think
shame.
Quite wise, though, because, you know, I think you know, the original offence, he could have rallied the public round, but the trouble with celebrities and Twitter is that I think they don't think before they tweet, and I think the first rule in life is think before you tweet. Alec Baldwin realised that when you start saying the trouble with American Airlines is they employ Catholic gym school teachers from the 1950s as their flight attendants, you're starting to get into an area where you're likely to see your reputation being damaged rather than the airlines. Femi, what do you think?
I thought you were going to admit you were playing with him. Are you about to
Are you the friend? You are the friend who was playing words with.
I was not, no.
No, that's a shame. I wonder who that friend would be, because they play a footnote in history.
Matthew, what have people been listening to?
Chatter from America with me, Matthew Bishop.
Femi OK.
And Henry Timms.
Chatter from America is produced by Femi OK at WNYC Radio in New York. The opinions you've been listening to belong strictly to the chatterers and not to the organisations they work for. Thanks for listening.
We didn't hear about Matthew having tea with KKR.
I thought it was KKK first of all. I was like, wow. Oh, I thought I left all that behind in Georgia. You're in the KKK. I brought my own hood.